taking up more than my fair share of the aisle. Yes, staggering in an afternoon.
I'm just
all right.
Before my time.
Oh, has it?
Well, and I...
Oops. Oh.
It's more stressful. Yeah. Imbibing becomes more frequent.
I suspect it still occurs, but I think it's by...
kept in practice. It's more of a, you know, and I know. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, there's snappy folks. I mean, actually, when I was
like, no obligation, really.
Be ready.
And I'm in trouble.
You probably got a drop. It wasn't. Whoa.
Where did you move?
Are you going today? Yes, American Express. No. So that was a real shock to my system. But, since I'm there.
Anybody else coming in?
It used to be a liability.
We take ourselves to home, you know? Get used to this, huh?
You know,
yeah.
That was a horrendous idea, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, God, Lynn, you just spoiled my day.
Who would have thought it?
No, yeah, we've both been here our fair share. So. Oh, really?
Oh, I don't know.
That's a scary thought. Oh, okay.
Do the peace legislation.
I don't want to have a delayed stress syndrome guy in the back of me.
Okay. Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications is in order. I'm going to get that right one of these days. welcome back, members. It's good to see you and everybody in the audience and to our testifiers. Today we're going to be talking about the impact of our state energy programs and how it's had, what it's doing to our industry and our jobs. We've been getting a lot of feedback about the RES and the SIP programs, and some favorable and some with some concerns that perhaps we need to work on. So that's kind of what I would like to address today, because as you know, it's all about jobs and economic recovery. So whatever we can do to still meet our goals and be environmentally sound, but still be cognizant of the ratepayers and our employers is very, very important. So it's just going to be a really great day to testify, ask questions, and hear what we have to say about that. So first we're going to hear testimony from the industries that have benefited from the RES or the SIP program. And we have Mr. Hinkle and Mr. Cannon with us. Thank you very much for being here. And if you could state your names for the record.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm the policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association.
My name is Joel Cannon. I'm chief executive of 10K Solar in Bloomington, Minnesota.
Wonderful. Mr. Hinkle, Mr. Cannon, who would like to start? And if you could keep your comments to around 10 minutes total, that'd be nice. Thank you.
Thanks again, Senator Rosen and committee members, for the opportunity to talk about how solar works for Minnesota. What we're going to talk about, what I'm going to address specifically, is solar, a Minnesota job engine. Solar works for Minnesota by providing family-supporting jobs now. Solar grows all across the state. Solar represents energy independence and adds even more jobs, and it's going to be a part of a new reliable grid with still more jobs. We're talking about good-paying jobs all over Minnesota. Jobs that support families, that install solar projects, design and engineer solar products, manufacture materials, equipment, and components, train solar professionals, and develop and finance projects. These are lots of jobs. Let's look at the numbers a little bit. at least 3,000 families to sustaining wage jobs, most in manufacturing, and this is a number that is essentially used based on some of the projects that are developing on rooftops in a modular fashion in California. 3,000 jobs per megawatt, 58 megawatts of solar, and this is based on a calculator that has been put together by the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab, Jobs and Economic Development Impacts, called JEDI. I just want to caution folks about this number. It's correct in that we're talking about a 58-megawatt project of solar would create that number of jobs. We're not suggesting that for each subsequent 58 megawatts or for each year, if we were to get a solar electricity standard in place, that we would then be able to stack another subsequent 3,000 on 3,000. But for the first year, in that category of good jobs now, we see 3,000 family wage jobs from a fairly typical kind of rooftop commercial installation that's being installed in other parts of the country that do have solar electricity standards. What's the cost effectiveness? It's 14.1 jobs per $1 million invested. It's created by solar projects compared to 5.3 jobs for fossil fuel energy development. It's also inclusive. The solar industry creates jobs across all skill and educational levels with significant opportunity for workers with lower skill and educational credentials. These are good jobs now. Solar projects can be proposed, installed, and operational in a matter of months. Coal, nuclear, and even natural gas electricity generation projects take 5 to 10 years from initial proposal before a shovel ever hits the ground. We need to get the economy going now. Energy independence equals in-state jobs. Minnesotans export at least $20 billion, that's a B, roughly $3,800 per Minnesotan per year to other states and countries to pay for energy, according to 2008 U.S. DOE Energy Information Administration data. The boost to our economy from keeping more energy dollars cycling in the state's economy will be enormous. This slide is put in just to give you some information about what's going on with the development of a new, a lot of people call it the smart grid. Professor Masoud Amin of the university has been quite visible and prolific in expounding the benefits and the necessity of moving quickly towards adoption of a new grid that's more reliable. Solar will be an integral part of that, as it's an important source of peak power delivery. And this is going to generate even more jobs as we grow out the smart grid. There's a nice graphic that at some point I'd encourage you to take a look at, because there's an awful lot of discussion about incentives and subsidies, and I think this helps put it into perspective and helps people understand that, by comparison, solar is by far the least incentivized energy generation process. On December 14th, just about a month ago, we held our first Minnesota Solar Manufacturing Supply Chain Roundtable. The gentleman to my right was one of the speakers, along with a number of other people. Senator Anderson was present, and we appreciate that. There were about 55 businesses from around the state that came in on a very challenging snowy day to talk about how we could move Minnesota into a short list of states that would be considered for significant solar investment. Right now we're not considered, but with the robust solar manufacturing supply chain that we already have in place and a strong demand signal, we'd move dramatically into that position. These are some of the jobs that are coming online from solar and small wind installation that complement the businesses that I just spoke of. And these are the businesses around the state. You have this map in your packet. There's also a copy of a really nice Minnesota Monthly article that talks about 10K Solar. 10K Solar is one of our success stories for a startup. And that success is in no small part the result of the work of Joel Cannon, CEO of 10K. I'll get this up for...
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Cannon, Mr. Hinkle, Senator Brown has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes,
I didn't mean to
Madam
rush.
Chair, Mr. Hinkle, going back to your slide, Solar Works for Minnesota with the federal subsidies graph, I have a hard time reading that, but my question is, would you say the majority of solar companies receive tax subsidies or state or federal grants for their capital costs or long-term operations?
The subsidies right now, the answer would be no. The subsidies or the incentives are primarily aimed at generating demand. There is one program that was developed during the stimulus that was targeted at manufacturers. It has already formally expired. It may be extended. It was the 48C program. The program that did get extended was the 1603 Treasury Grant Program, which is aimed at providing incentives for the development of renewable energy generation projects. In our state, we have some other incentives. Some are provided by utilities such as Xcel's Excellent Solar Rewards Program. We also have, as a result of legislation last year, a rebate for Minnesota-made manufacturing.
Thank you.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Hinkle, can you tell me what's the price of solar compared to energy from other sources like wind or coal?
Mr. Cannon.
If I may, Madam Chair, I do address that in my discussion.
Okay.
currently, we can deliver solar energy for between 17 cents and 22 cents a kilowatt hour, depending upon the location in the country, because obviously the more sun you get, the less it costs. Completely unsubsidized. That's the unsubsidized rate. We're on track to be, we're competitive with grid energy in the high-priced power markets in the world today. We're on track to be competitive in every power market in the world within 3 to 4 years.
Cannon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will be brief, efficient with your time. My name is Joel Cannon. I have been in the energy business all of my life. prior to my current engagement with 10K Solar, I started a company with my brother in his basement, which we grew to a couple of $100 million enterprise out in Golden Valley. And that company actually was Smart Grid before Smart Grid was hip. And we provide technology that enables, among other things, the Xcel Energy Saver Switch program and programs like it in utilities across North America. I'm not here to tell you that alternative energy is good for its own sake. It's good because it's good business. Energy is the biggest market in the world, and to the extent that we can deliver a kilowatt hour more cheaply and more cleanly, then you can purchase one from other sources. We have an opportunity for tremendous growth. a few slides. We're just going to go through them ridiculously quickly. Lynn, if you might just go quickly there. There's a photograph of the system we make. My company started in 2008. There's a timeline, a couple slides up, that might be worth showing. We started as a research and development company in Bloomington. We're here because we live here. But the environment in Minnesota makes it possible to do what we do. We use the University of Minnesota labs. We make a rooftop commercial system and have spent a lot of money with St. Anthony Falls Lab. If we didn't have access to that, we'd have to travel somewhere else. We have a close partnership with 3M and with other materials companies in the area, and we have access to great skilled labor. Our company makes a very unique proprietary solar technology. We're not the only company in the world who makes a smart I call it smart solar panel, but we do believe that we are the ahead of the pack, that we have technology that is further along in commercialization and more cost-effective than anything else in the world. We employ 52 people in Bloomington, Minnesota. That number was zero 24 months ago. Well, we were working, but we didn't get paid, so we didn't count that. we've attracted over $10 million in investment capital in Minnesota, and that number will be much larger shortly. We expect to employ about 150 people in Minnesota by year end. We have a great production workforce. It includes folks who've been laid off from Northwest Airlines, folks who've been laid off from other technology businesses. And we actually also, in our production line, we have a few college grads, young men and women who, there's three of them, who got college degrees, were unable to find careers, and said we want to start at the ground floor, and they're actually out building solar panels in the factory, and we'll bring those folks up through the ranks, and they'll be the leadership in the company as they get more experience, and they'll actually know how things get done. We are globally focused on being globally competitive and making delivering the lowest levelized cost of energy from commercial rooftop solar. So we have orders for systems in addition to a lot of business in Minnesota. I do tell you, the Made in Minnesota solar program was not my idea, but it has been very helpful to us. What it does with a startup company is helps you build your resume. So you can say, yeah, we've got, you know, all these projects in, and they, you know, they do what we say, even though we do expect most of our business actually to come from outside Minnesota in future years. It's been very helpful. We have orders in.
So you're saying, Mr. Cannon, it's sexy to say it's made in Minnesota? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. That's right. And the solar resource in Minnesota, it is. The solar resource here is actually pretty good because solar likes cold temperatures. So a sunny, cold day is a very, very efficient solar day. That's my story.
Mr. Cannon, or? Senator Anderson, what are some of the trends happening in solar nowadays?
If I might, Madam Chair, solar, the technology that we make is, solar cells like to operate independently. Traditionally, the only efficient way to put them together is to string them in series like Christmas tree lights. And so the weakest member governs the output of the module. And there's been no success in efficiently packaging them so that each can operate independently. And that is really the nut that we have cracked. A lot of other companies are working on electronic solutions to make solar panels smarter. Solar panels can be a fire hazard because they don't shut off unless the sun shuts off. So by embedding electronics, we make them perfectly safe because if there is a fault or a short, they shut down. We can run them now at low voltage very efficiently, which is safer. So the sorts of trends are to make the technology easier to deploy, safer to deploy, and while, of course, bringing costs down. I hope I answered your question.
Yes, you did.
If I might
add
to that, the report that came out just this last August, Vice President Biden's office, in collaboration with the Department of Energy, put out a pretty intense analysis of what had happened with stimulus funds in relation to what was called the clean energy economy. And one of the things that they said, and I think Joel and I have had this discussion a couple of times, they're projecting that the cost of solar will get to grid parity by 2015. And we're seeing that startles people because I think people have thought for a while that, you know, solar was nice and there'd be some first adopters out there, but it would remain at the margin of the economy. And I think what we're seeing is that in large part because of the lower level of subsidy and our being a strong participant in the market, that the costs have been driven down quickly. And that you're going to see significant deployment of solar over the next 5 years. And we're hoping that Minnesota capitalizes, moves into the center of that discussion. We think there's a vast amount of investment that will follow as solar becomes more available.
Thank you. Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, Mr. Cannon, you know, you talked about the prices coming down, and he asked one of my questions, but are you talking large-scale solar, or are you looking at when will it be cost competitive, or should I say, is there a move for the, just like the average residential homeowner to purchase a unit like this?
Very good question, sir.
Cannon.
Sorry, forgot my protocol. residential will always cost more. It's just, you know, little systems cost more because you can't spread the labor over, you know, a larger balance of equipment. Right now, ground mount is the cheapest. Commercial roof is second, and residential is the most expensive. Our goal is to make commercial rooftop at parity with ground mount by taking out balance of system cost. We're business people first, and it's our job to make a competitive product, and we believe commercial rooftop is the best place for distributed solar. Residential, I believe, is definitely at least 2 to 3 years behind commercial scale and utility scale in reaching price parity, if that answers your question.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming up.
Senator. Thank you.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Benson.
Just a couple of questions. Thank you for coming. What is the usable life on these rooftop systems, and what is the payback period? And also, you have done tremendous work on running, I believe it's in parallel instead of in series on your cells. But are you working on storage? Because that seems to be one of the big challenges. Or are there other people that you would partner with in improving storage so we get consistent delivery? So three questions: usable life, payback period, and where's storage going?
Mr. Cannon?
Again, a good question. And yes, you're right. It's a combination of series parallel, but yes, you got that. Usable life, we guarantee is 20 years. Quite honestly, there's really not any reason the system shouldn't last 30 or 40. Silicon doesn't degrade as long as you protect and encapsulate it properly, and that's part of our value proposition. Payback period varies significantly depending upon the energy price and the cost of money and everything. So, you know, with subsidies, you can get down to, you know, less than 5 years. Without subsidies in some markets, you can be into the low teens. Right now, I'm pretty comfortable that unsubsidized, we can be below 10, but that's still a little long for investment. So, you know, we've got a couple of years left of kind of helping this fledgling industry get going. And then the last question is storage. We have engineered our particular system is designed for use with storage and removes some of the necessary charge controlling hardware that is necessary. It takes the cost out of using the system with storage. Originally, the business model was to target storage markets, but they aren't very big, so we focused on commercial rooftop first. We do have a partnership with a couple of different intelligent storage companies, including one based in Brainerd called Silent Power. Silent Power, based in Brainerd, and they make a intelligent storage system and an inverter to convert the DC to usable AC. And in fact, I'm missing a design meeting with them to be here, but that's okay. There's a lot smarter guys than I am to work on that stuff.
Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Cannon, and otherwise Mr. Hinkle. But I think as we're talking about this, I want to kind of keep it short. But I'm really, you know, in understanding economies of scale to get this stuff down to price parity, is there any industry studies that show us at what point these things cross, how much production is out there, who's producing panels, and at what point does it cross so we get this price parity? And I mean, if there's a study, you can just say there's a study and get it to us later so we can, you know, get as much information in the committee hearing as possible.
Mr. Cannon.
Yes, sir. There's lots of data. I would have to pick the best one. What I would probably send you would be a market analyst report, and I'll do that to be efficient with your time.
Wonderful. Thank you
very much. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Oh, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, and what I've heard is that, well, production of solar, it's just growing dramatically worldwide. And when we passed the rebate last year, we talked about the fact that most solar panels are now made in China, and that market has grown enormously. And so part of what we were trying to do with this rebate is encourage local companies mm-hmm. to so that, you know, we wouldn't just put up the panels, but we would actually manufacture them here, so we'd get more of those jobs and more of that supply chain. So I'm glad to hear that it's useful. And I guess it would be helpful for this committee to hear if there's any, I don't know, if you think there's any policies or things that would be good for the solar industry to grow in Minnesota, or things that would be bad for the solar industry to grow in Minnesota, what, that we should know about. Sorry to put you on the spot with that. But
Senator Anderson, thank you for the question, Madam Chair. I think the most dramatic single and strong benefit that this committee or the legislature could enact that would help solar is to send what I call a strong demand signal, that if Minnesota was to align itself with, it's approximately 18, it is 18 states that have developed what are called solar electricity standards. Some are 0.2%, some are at 4.5, New Jersey is at 5% by 2020. Coupled with our really robust manufacturing capacity, I think that would vault us into a really almost singular status in this country for the investment in solar and the scaling up of significant new industries in this state, not just the generation. So it would be a demand signal that corresponds to what I think is a really strong supply capacity that already exists in the state.
So, Madam Chair, just to briefly, I was really had a really exciting opportunity the last couple of days to participate in a national meeting to talk about different energy. Well, the only thing I want to say about it is there's a lot of activity going on around the country, and it's a really competitive world out there for states that want to grow their industries in different kinds of emerging energy fields and clean energy. And I had an opportunity to meet with Governor Ritter, who's just the outgoing governor of Colorado, and so he's who said he's only been in, he was only in for one term, but he did an unbelievable sort of platform of proposals. He said he signed 57 bills during that time to help grow the energy economy in Colorado, and they've focused on wind and solar and natural gas, and that what they've done is established themselves in a real leadership position. And so if we're interested in trying to support this industry in Minnesota, it's getting really competitive, and there's lots of other states that are interested in that too. So I hope that Minnesota will, you know, keep our leadership position, because we have so much potential here, and we've got a lot of companies already, and I'd like to see them expand.
Yeah, Senator Anderson, I think we've done a really bang-up job, too, with your RES and what we passed and what we've already got in place, too. So this is a very good discussion. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Your comments on that. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Rolling here. Beth, Ms. Soholt and Mr. Seck, please, if you could both come up. Hold.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Beth Soholt. I'm the Executive Director of Wind on the Wires, and we are a St. Paul-based nonprofit working in nine upper Midwest states on wind power and transmission issues. We focus on technical, policy, regulatory, and education aspects of removing the barriers to bringing wind power to market. And we have a wide variety of membership. One of our members, Tim Seck from Iberdrola, is here with me today. And I just wanted to have a few opening comments and then turn it over to Mr. Seck to continue the presentation. I applaud the committee for having this conversation about our energy policy and where we've been, where we're going. The committee will obviously hear a wide variety of perspectives on job creation and economic development as it relates to energy policy in the state, and it's a good discussion. It's no secret that Minnesota has a rich wind regime, and that wind power in the last 5 to 7 to 10 years has brought much to Minnesota in the way of jobs and local economic impact. According to the American Wind Energy Association, Minnesota has nearly 1,800 megawatts, or enough to power 525,000 homes, 1,800 megawatts in the ground and spinning. That equates to 2,000 to 3,000 jobs, direct and indirect, in 2009 alone. Property tax payments to local, from project owners to local governments in greater Minnesota, was approximately $5 million in 2009, and annual land lease payments of approximately $5.5 million. We all know that it takes an army to put up a wind project from start to finish, and it's not just the wind developers, but it's the whole supply chain, from the truck drivers that bring the cement to crane operators, earth movers, cement workers, and a whole plethora of construction management, consulting, and engineering jobs to develop a wind farm. We have a lot of the supply chain here in Minnesota. We're working to make sure our public policy stays strong so that we've got that signal for the jobs to locate here in Minnesota. And I think that it's really notable to say that CapEx just did, the CapEx 2020 initiative, just had a jobs report that came out in November 2010. And there are quite a few jobs that are being supplied from the putting up transmission as well. So I just want to make two other comments, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Seck. We've got quite a few facts and figures from projects that went up in the last several years that I think I won't spend a lot of time talking to the committee about today. I think we'll follow up with some numbers for you. But a lot of jobs and a lot of economic development, tax revenues, payments are going to from these various wind farms to the local communities. And then I just want to touch on cost a little bit, because I know that the committee has been hearing things about the cost of wind energy. People are very sensitive about the cost of energy in general these days, particularly if you're a business in Minnesota. And we know that many of the utilities testified last week that they are on track to meet or exceed their RES goals. And I'll just note that wind has historically been a very cost-effective new resource for Xcel Energy, for example. Xcel is currently looking for an additional 250 megawatts of wind energy, and all indications are that despite the cost fluctuations that have happened over the last few years, that those 250 megawatts of new wind will continue to be a cost-effective resource for Xcel Energy. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Seck, good to see you again.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name's Tim Seck, and I'd like to say it's good to be back here. My interest in wind really started in this very room about 20 years ago, and it's been a while since I've been back, and it's fun to be here, fun to see some familiar faces, and talk about how our industry has changed dramatically in that time. As Beth noted, I'm with Iberdrola Renewables, and I'll tell you a little bit about who we are, talk about our investments in Minnesota, talk about our most recent project that we developed in Minnesota, and then talk about wind jobs generally in Minnesota. Iberdrola Renewables is the largest owner-operator of wind in the world. We've developed 12,000 megawatts. In the U.S., we've developed about 4,600 megawatts. I guess my role in the company is I'm in charge of their development in the Midwest. I oversee our development efforts in 12 states, where we've developed 1,700 megawatts over the last 7 years. I'm based here in Minnesota, and like I said, I've been involved in wind, looking back to the policy side, for 20 years, and as a developer for about 16. Iberdrola's investment in Minnesota is about $1 billion. We've invested $1 billion in Minnesota over the last 7 years, and that's resulted in about 550 megawatts, or about 330 turbines around the state, which means we're Beth mentioned that the number 1,800, we're over 25% of Minnesota's wind turbines are ours, and we hope to continue increasing that percentage. And Minnesota's been a key state, and it's been a great state for us to invest in. Our major customers for our Minnesota projects are Xcel Energy and Great River. And I guess with that bit of overview on Minnesota, I want to talk about our investment in our most recent project, which is called Elm Creek 2. You've got a fact sheet that was distributed just a minute ago. It talks a little bit about the project. It's a 150-megawatt project, and we decided to build that project kind of at the bottom of the economic dip that we are going through. We made the decision and in turn invested over $300 million in Jackson and Martin County in south central Minnesota. This project resulted in about 340 construction jobs at its peak, and we had, in addition to those direct construction jobs, we employed over 45 other companies that were involved in our wind project. And it ranged from, you know, a very large project or contracts with companies like Mortenson out of Golden Valley to Anderson Trucking out of St. Cloud to, you know, Westwood out of Eden Prairie to Barr and Edina. And then it ranged to the local lumber yard, the local auto shop, the local machine shop, the local concrete company. There were a whole bunch of people involved in this investment that we made in Minnesota, and it's been a great experience developing it in Minnesota. Of our over $300 million investment in this project, about $75 million of that investment will go directly to Minnesota-based companies, Minnesota landowners, local units of government, townships, and folks around the state. And that's over a 20-year life. You know, we expect this project will have a life much longer than 20 years, and so I expect that number to be much higher as you look beyond the 20-year life. But you know, that $75 million investment will have a ripple effect or a multiplier effect that will create a lot of other jobs and economic opportunities beyond just this project. Like I said, I got my start right here in this committee during the Prairie Island debate when the Senate and the House and the governor passed a law that required certain investments in renewable energy. Well, because Minnesota was an early adopter of renewable energy standards, we've got a number of companies based in Minnesota that got early, that received early experience in wind, and they've built on that experience, and now are national players around the country developing wind energy. For example, Mortenson Construction, and which is based in, like I said, in Golden Valley, and then another company called Blattner, which is based in Avon. Those two companies based in Minnesota have probably constructed over half the wind projects around the country. I know that they've developed two-thirds of Iberdrola's projects around the country, and there are several other companies based in Minnesota that are national players in wind. You've got Barr Engineering. They've developed, they've been our engineer on our turbine foundations for, I think, almost all of our projects around the country. Westwood Professionals, based in Eden Prairie, has done surveying and road design at a number of our projects around the country. The list goes on. We've got law firms and other environmental professional groups that are doing work not only for Minnesota projects, but for projects around the country. You've got tower manufacturers based, along the edge of Minnesota, you've got one owned by an Otter Tail affiliate called DM&I. It's based in Fargo, and clearly there's jobs both in Fargo, Moorhead, and we've used those turbines around, not only in Minnesota, but in other projects of ours around the region. And we've used blades manufactured from the Suzlon plant in southwestern Minnesota for some of our projects outside of Minnesota. We've imported many turbine components through the Duluth port for projects in Minnesota and outside of Minnesota. And so there are a number of jobs associated with wind, and You know, I think, you know, the legislature and the policymakers of the state deserve, you know, a big pat on the back for that, creating the environment that's fostered this kind of economic development in our state, and put us in the leader in terms of being a job creator and player in the wind market, both nationally and actually in Canada too. So I guess with that I'll wrap it up and be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Mitzen.
Thank you, Mr. Sick. You mentioned that some of the blades are manufactured in Minnesota, but I think, is it about 100% of the turbines are imported through Duluth?
Mr. Sick.
We've used Duluth to import some of our turbines, but it just depends on which manufacturer.
But they're overseas, aren't they, Madam Chair? Where they're made?
One of our largest turbine suppliers is General Electric, which is a U.S.-based manufacturer. The turbine that we have that we're using the most of, we've got an order for probably 5,000 megawatts with a company called Gamesa. And they're a Spanish company, but 75% of the turbine components are manufactured in the U.S.
Okay, that's very encouraging, Madam Chair. I didn't know it was that. I thought mainly they were assembled here, but that's good news to hear that a lot of it's manufactured in their state,
Senator
and their country.
Senator Howell?
Madam Chair, Mr. Zek, could you explain to me how some of these come to market, or how it looks like your company takes it from start to finish, but is there another business where people just get the landowners to sign in and kind of get everything packaged and ready to go and then sell it to somebody else to actually construct the wind turbines? Can you just tell me a little bit about the industry on that?
Mr. Sack?
Sure, I'd be happy to. There's different, there are kind of start-to-finish developers like Iberdrola, and there are other developers that will go out and find a site, get it under lease control, and take it to, you know, various levels of readiness, but then they bring in a partner to kind of finish the development of the project. And we've done that with a number of entities around the Midwest where, you know, we'll buy from parties who have done some of that early term development. Wind can be developed in a variety of different structures and methods, and, you know, every developer is different in terms of how they, you know, develop their projects and their partners that they bring in.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Sack, are most of your projects in Minnesota, are they CBED?
Madam Chair, they are not CBED, but the and we haven't applied to be CBED, but we think that we could, you know, qualify some of them to be CBED if that made sense. But we haven't pursued that to date.
I thought this Elm Creek one was seabed light. That's what I like to call it. So it wasn't a seabed, but it's kind of seabed light.
Yeah. The Elm Creek one project has a very strong local component, and that is because, I guess back to Senator Howe's point, you know, in terms of, you know, who you partner with, we essentially bought that project from a group of landowners, and as part of that sale, they retained a much higher percentage of local of economic participation in the project. They receive a percentage of the revenue associated with the project, in addition to kind of the traditional turbine payments and acreage payments. But the difference is we don't have a flip. We don't offer them a flip to have ownership in the out years, which we might need to do to get it qualified as seabed. But we haven't gone down that path. But the economic benefits are much higher in the Elm Creek 1 project that you mentioned and in the Elm Creek 2 project that you have a fact sheet on.
Okay. And members will probably have to have a good discussion about community-based projects like that, seabed. So, Senator Mitzen.
On the transmission or the lines, is there enough capacity out there? I'm thinking of mainly Buffalo Ridge where the growth is moving along pretty good. Is there enough right away and lines to go future to go into the future from there?
I've got the guru sitting right next to me.
Because people don't like, Madam Chair, people don't like transmission lines either. So,
So hold.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, we do need more transmission capacity. Actually, what we need is we need the flexibility in our infrastructure to be able to deliver more wind energy. And so if you like wind, you know, if you love wind, you at least have to be able to live with
the
transmitting
lines.
And so far we haven't figured out how to magically, you know, move it through the air. We need the transmission lines. That's why every time you see a wind turbine, you really should have the transmission line running behind it, because it's part and parcel of the same thing. So our Minnesota utilities are working hard to identify and move those transmission lines forward. I think anything the legislature can do to help them, it would be appreciated. We do need more transmission in order to meet our RES.
Senator Benson.
There are some measures here of production of your project capacity, particularly for Elm Creek, but in general, capacity doesn't necessarily match deliverable electricity. Could you address that? Also, payback period on one of these projects, subsidized and unsubsidized. And then same question I asked before, storage. If we want to join in a grid, we have to be good friends and join in a consistent way. And so there would have to be some storage instead of randomly coming on and offline depending on when the wind was blowing. So three questions. Capacity versus available energy. What is your payback period, and what is the storage future?
Mr. Sack.
On capacity versus availability, you know, a good wind project typically has an availability factor, meaning it's ready to generate electricity about 97 to 98.5% of the time. But you're right, the wind doesn't always blow, and I think capacity factors for the sites that have been developed to date in Minnesota probably range from 37 to, 42-43%, which means that the turbine is at its rated capacity that amount of time during the year. It'll be running more than that, but, more than 40% of the time, but on average it will make that production number, in that 37-42% range.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question on the capacity versus availability?
Yes, thank you.
Your second question on payback, every developer, I'm sure, has a different economic model that they look at. We look at our projects over 20 years. We need to hit a certain return threshold in order for us, for our parent company, to make the investment. It's in the single. Our return requirement is in the single digit, so it's not like we're making extremely large amounts of money. We think it's a good investment, and over its 20-year life, we think we'll meet our return requirement. And if it operates longer than that, then we'll have additional upside beyond that. In terms of storage. Right now, wind is, you need to use wind whenever it's generated. I think some folks are looking at storage, and I think that's going to become more attractive. But right now, it's kind of a niche, kind of R&D type technology. And I don't think we've hit wind penetration levels yet in our grid that storage is absolutely required. I think that we can, and I think utilities have demonstrated that they can, throttle back, they can kind of manage their system by kind of moving their different resources around to kind of match the load that's always changing and the level of generation that's always changing from their fleet of plants.
Yeah,
so, but I think storage is kind of on the horizon, but it's not a major technology yet.
Senator Hill.
Madam Chair, Mr. Zach, can you explain just a little bit about the economics behind it? Because we heard some earlier testimony on a previous day about, at night, they don't need the windmills to turn at night because the capacity isn't there for it. And so I'm just wondering, is the cost of electricity, how is that sold? Does it go way down off-peak hours, or is it just not being used in off-peak hours? Because it seemed to be some suggestion that we have too much capacity at off-peak.
Madam Chair and Senator Howe, What I think, and I'm guessing it was the utilities when they testified, were talking about how you integrate the wind that we have into the grid and into the whole portfolio. Certainly there are times when we have very low load at night and we have windy conditions at night, so there's a lot of wind being produced. But that's why we have flexibility in our transmission grid. If we don't need it here, it's needed somewhere else. And we always have energy moving back and forth over our electricity grid. And so if Minnesota doesn't need it, Wisconsin or Illinois might need it. That's why the utilities are part of a large power pool. And when Minnesota imports a lot of our electricity, a lot of our generation to serve our load. And so it's flowing into Minnesota when we need the energy, and it's flowing out of Minnesota when we have too much. And so it's this continual meeting demand and back and forth shifting of the generation. We're not dumping wind, if that's what you're meaning. It's not a lower price at night. I mean, the prices in the power pool are generally different during different times of the day. But we are, I think all the utilities and the power pool in general are doing a good job of integrating the resources that we have into our grid effectively. The Midwest Independent System Operator, the grid operator, has about 9,000 megawatts in their 13-state footprint. And so they're doing a very good job of allowing the wind to blow and serve load when it's blowing. And then other resources in the pool pick up the slack when the wind is not blowing. And that keeps us balanced and keeps the lights on.
Follow up, Mr.
Senator.
Madam Chair. So we're not at any time dumping power?
Not that I'm aware of. I think that there are certainly times when the integration issues are a little bit more challenging when we have low load. But certainly I'm not aware of times when we're dumping it. We have had in the past when we've had lack of transmission, we have happened the utilities do what's called curtailments. And so they would have to ask a wind plant to back down. But they're continually looking at other resources, too, and adjusting those other resources, not just curtailing the wind. So it's kind of a delicate balance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that point, a lot of people are excited about the idea of electrifying more cars. And if we have more of our car fleet electrified, we'll use less foreign oil, be less dependent on oil, and they're just a lot cleaner and more efficient. And can you speak to how that would match up? I mean, if you could use some low off-peak power, wind power to help charge up cars, is that something you could see that we would have the capacity to do on a big scale in Minnesota?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, electric vehicles are kind of like storage. And so you use that, you charge your car, probably at night or at off-peak hours. And so it is a good battery. It's going to take a lot of enhancements to the infrastructure and changing our mix and the way we do things. But the cars would be like a big battery, it would kind of be a win-win-win. You'd get to hopefully generate from clean sources. You would be charging those batteries when in more economical hours. And so your load curve or the shape of your load would change, and we'd be using energy efficiently.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think I mentioned this at another meeting, but I think it'd be helpful for this committee to go out to Energy Park in St. Paul and look at the MISA at the grid. And I think that would help Senator Howe and a lot of us it helped me to understand how this product, if you will, has moved around the area. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to see how this thing works. And I think that would show how you can move it from here to there to South Dakota, North Dakota, whatever. I don't know how big our area is. It's 7-8 states. But that would be helpful, I think, to see how that works.
I think that's an excellent idea because it's hard to understand that when you plug something in, it really affects the grid down even in Iowa.
Yeah.
And it's all interconnected. And it'd be fascinating, Senator Metzen. Good idea.
Chair
is that in your district?
No, I.
Mine.
Anderson. District Energy Park. Okay.
Forget it. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Yeah. I wish it wasn't.
We will plan that. That's a great idea.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Benson.
I did have a question. You mentioned we don't ever dump wind. Do you ever sell it at below cost, below the cost of production?
Ms. Holt. Mr. Sack.
Madam Chair.
Well, we, you know, if we have a contract with a utility, it's at a fixed price, we will sell it to them at that price. If we have a project that doesn't have a power purchase agreement, like our Elm Creek 2 wind project, then we need to, and we're selling that the output of that project into the market. If the price drops to a level or we're not making money and we're losing money, then that's then we'll make that economic decision and could decide to curtail. There are times when the price of power goes negative in the market, and that's when we would make a decision to turn off that wind project.
How do you explain why it's negative? It's probably negative because there's excess production compared to demand.
That's right. MISO is trying to send a signal to generators that there is an excess of power on the grid, or there's some issue that they're trying to solve on the grid, and a negative price does that. So, it doesn't happen very often. It happens, it's very seldom that the price is negative, but that certainly is a possibility, and we would need to cross that bridge when we come to it.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Getting back to seabed for just 1 second, not really a question for the testifiers, but I think I heard you say that are we going to have a seabed day here in the committee?
Senator Dibble, you can have whatever day you want.
Right.
That's a great day.
Well, the only reason is
complicated.
Mr. Seck mentioned the flip, and I've just gotten some clarification mm-hmm. from counsel that while the flip is still something that we can make use of, we did expand the notion of what seabed is, and so we don't have to use the flip mm-hmm. model, the local ownership mm-hmm. model like we had to before, which proved to be so problematic. But we can construe what local benefit is, by deriving mm-hmm. financing locally or manufacturing locally, some other those things that we can count as a local benefit. So I'm curious to know, I don't know if it's too soon after we made the change, but it'd be really interesting to know if that seems to be helping the whole seabed idea.
We'll work on that. Thank you. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble on that, I think we should have a day where we talk about our policies, return on investment. I got to be part of the presentation at the bioscience conference last year with people that's what we were dealing with was the formulas and what we needed so we can – I think we can get a good group of people in here that can tell us how our policies work, how financing works, how we can fine-tune all that. That's for a whole nother day, but that is something that's key to understanding this and at what point does something have a return on investment, what are the payback periods, how long does the equipment last. A lot of these things go into these factors, and a lot of us don't know the details, so I think that's a great idea to spend probably a couple days on mm-hmm. and shape it out in different things that way so we understand not only our policies, but how do our policies affect the ability to finance something, or how do you run it out for that return on investment?
Absolutely, and that's what it's all about. And obviously, probably should have scheduled 2 days for this discussion because this is a very good discussion. I've completely lost control of this committee. So no, but this is the wonderful discussions that we're having, and it is all about jobs and the economy and the direction that we're taking the state. So thank you, you two. I really appreciate coming up. And then Mr. Strom.
Second.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sheldon Strom from the Center for Energy and Environment, and I'll start working from the handout to save time while Jennifer Edwards, one of our new policy analysts, gets the PowerPoint going. And I know you're short of time, so I'll try and be quick and answer your questions if you have any. For those of you who don't know me and my organization, the Center for Energy and Environment is a nonprofit organization that's been doing energy efficiency work for almost 30 years. We also do some work on renewable energy. I won't go into all the things we've done, but we've served about 70,000 homes and businesses with our program. We've done at least 100 applied research projects related to energy and renewables. We provide financing of over $125 million, mostly to energy efficiency projects. We also manage a very large project for the Metropolitan Airports Commission that reduces noise transmission using a lot of the same strategies that we use to reduce energy use. We were selected to run a program for all the state's buildings in 2009, and that is going well. We also do a lot of building recommissioning. We do some programs for utilities and a lot of other stuff. So I wanted to talk a little bit about energy efficiency and utility-sponsored energy efficiency. And the utility programs are implemented in Minnesota under a program called the Conservation Improvement Program, or the Conservation Improvement Plans. This is the CIP program. This is a program that's been around in Minnesota since the early 80s. It's not anything new, and its primary purpose in being created was to produce the energy we need at the lowest possible cost. So all of the statutes say that you produce this if the cost of conservation is less than the cost of new energy supplies. And that's its only purpose, is to produce energy at a low cost. In order to do that, it has to save energy that wouldn't otherwise be saved. So utilities have to design programs so they're not duplicating the savings that are occurring in the marketplace. The way they save all this money is they avoid new power plants, they avoid new transmission lines, they lower fuel costs, and so on. Energy efficiency also has the added benefit, it has a lot of great environmental benefits, it has essentially no environmental impact, but I want to emphasize that primarily the reason we do it is to save money. And we've been doing it for a long time. These two charts I'm going to show you show the historic demand savings for energy. This is the savings of peak power, usually expressed in megawatts or kilowatts. And a megawatt is the instantaneous production of power. If you produce a megawatt for an hour, then you've got a megawatt hour of energy. Both megawatts and megawatt hours are important. This chart that's up there now shows that historically our utilities, especially Xcel Energy, started doing a significant amount of efficiency in the early 90s. And led by Xcel, and you can see the early focus was on saving this peak power. And the reason they did that is that's the most economical time to be saving energy, is at times of system peak. But it's also important that you save energy over time as well. So the next table shows the energy savings from these same programs. And you'll see that these programs grew, they were very small initially, and they grew significantly. And that's because initially the utilities chose the lowest hanging fruit, which are the strategies that focus primarily on peak demand. And over time, as they capitalized on a lot of that demand, they developed strategies that saved energy over a longer period of time. Though, as people were discussing earlier, it's very important when you save energy. The load shape of your energy efficiency is very important. So if you save energy at 2 o'clock on an October evening, it's not very valuable. If you save that energy at 4 o'clock on an August day when it's 95 degrees out there, it's much more valuable. So energy efficiency has to be designed in a way that optimizes its benefits. So Minnesota's been doing efficiency for a long time, and in 2007, Governor Pawlenty and the legislature changed the law a little bit about how utilities do efficiency. Previously, it was done under a spending mandate that said utilities should spend a certain amount of money, and these programs have to be cost-effective and have low avoided costs. That statute was changed to instead establish energy savings goals for utilities. And it's a subtle difference, but the idea was you wanted to have the metric be how much energy you save, not how much money you spend. And these savings goals would have increased, would increase the amount of energy that utilities have been saving. I think historically, Xcel Energy, for example, has been saving energy at about 7 or 8 tenths of 1%. So this goal would increase significantly what they're doing. Other utilities probably were saving about a half of 1%. So Minnesota passed this goal, which only comes into play actually January 1st of this year. So it was passed in 2007 to be implemented starting this year. And Minnesota's got a sort of a unique approach to this goal, because the goal is 1.5%, and the first 1.5% is to be saved by energy at the customer. The next 0.5% can be saved by energy savings at the customer, or if it's more economical for the utility, they can improve their systems, their transformers, some of their generation capacity, some of their transmission and distribution lines. So the idea is to make this as flexible as possible, because remember, the savings must be cost effective. And then sometimes there's confusion about this 1.5% goal. People think that we're trying to every year use 1.5% less. If we use 100 units this year, next year we use 98.5, the next year 97, and so on. And that isn't the intent. The intent is to slow growth by 1.5%. So if we're growing at 3% and we lower that to 1.5%, that's great. Because we're not trying to save energy in an absolute sense. We're trying to use energy more efficiently, because we want to continue to use that more energy more efficiently, plow those savings back into the economy, further stimulate economic growth. So energy efficiency is a great way of making businesses more efficient, making our economy more efficient, and actually growing the economy, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Minnesota is not the only state that has goals. 26 states around the country have goals of various types. I think the highest goals, I think, are in Vermont. I think they're 2% or higher. The Minnesota goals of 1 to 1.5% are pretty aggressive goals. 1.5 is pretty aggressive. 1 is more modest, but they are significant, even though the numbers seem small. The first state to have goals was Texas in 1999. So they established a goal to reduce their meet certain of their growth through energy efficiency. And it seems that most states find this to be a useful way of motivating utilities to maximize efficiency. Then looking at jobs in efficiency, there have been dozens and dozens of studies of jobs and energy efficiency and renewables and new power plants and so on. And there are so many of these studies that I suppose people's eyes glaze over. But the common thread in all those studies is the most economical way to meet your energy needs is energy efficiency. Typically, a utility program such as Xcel's might cost 2 cents per kilowatt hour saved. In the 90s, it was 1 cent a kilowatt hour saved. So it's very low cost. And energy efficiency tends to be labor intensive. So it creates more jobs than any other strategy. And there's a bunch of studies that show this, but I'm going to try and focus on more practical examples of why this is true. So this does the efficiency creates jobs in three very simple ways. Creates the jobs directly through the labor that's used in an energy efficiency project. Electricians that are installing new lighting, engineers that are doing an energy audit or recommissioning study, insulators that are insulating walls, heating and ventilation contracts that are installing new equipment. And as I mentioned, these tend to be labor-intensive projects, so these direct jobs are a significant portion of the investment. There are also some jobs created because you're purchasing equipment. Now, a lot of these jobs may be created in other states. If you're installing new lighting, a lot of those lamps come from other states, but a lot of the fixtures come from Minnesota. But maybe the most important thing about energy efficiency and what's unique about it is it's so low cost that it saves business in particular so much money that that money can then be reinvested in the economy to create a lot more jobs. And the reason we don't see all these jobs is they're dispersed all over the state. So I'm going to show you a slide a little later that I like to think of as like a lot of little tiny power plants all around the state, each creating jobs. So we don't see those jobs, but they're there. I'm going to give you a couple very simple examples of projects we've done so you can see how these jobs are created. This is a project we did a few years ago in Minneapolis. It's a large office building, Thrivent Financial Services. And this is a well-managed building, fairly modern building. They called us and asked. They had some comfort problems, and they wondered if they could reduce their energy use. So we did something called building recommissioning, which is basically a tune-up for a very large, complex building. Doesn't take a lot of money, doesn't require a lot of capital costs, requires a lot of knowledge. And what we did in this building is we went in and recommissioned it. So we optimized how all the building systems worked, made some changes to it. Almost all of the money, all the $185,000 it cost to do this, went to labor for our engineers, controls engineers, sheet metal workers that modified some of their equipment. And that project then saved Thrivent $190,000 a year, measured savings. So after the first year, Thrivent has another $190,000 they can spend on whatever they want, hiring new employees or whatever. So from Thrivent's standpoint, it's like they're getting a tax rebate every year from the state of $190,000. And these recommissioning projects can be very economical. They can have 1 or 2 year paybacks or maybe 3 year paybacks. They can be very efficient. Another example, and I'm just going to talk about examples of projects we run, is small commercial lighting. And small businesses are a sector where almost nobody saves energy because small businesses are busy. They run their small business. They don't know about energy. They don't know how to save it. They don't trust the contractors. They don't participate in utility rebate programs because they're not changing their systems. So about 10 years ago, we proposed to Xcel that we try and attack this market and see if we could actually have some impact on this. So we did something that's not rocket science. We said, well, what if we make it as simple and easy as possible for these businesses to do energy efficiency? So the program is that we market the program to the business. We do this free energy analysis. It's very sophisticated. We identify options for how they can select the best equipment. We calculate costs and benefits. We calculate their cash flow. We indicate what utility rebates are available. We tell them we'll process the rebates for them. We'll find a contractor for them, or if they've got a contractor, we'll ensure that there's the quality of the contractor's installation. And since we started this program, our first year we got savings of 55 kilowatts, and now we get typically 13,000 kilowatt savings a year.
Mr. Strom, we're going to have to hurry up. Okay. We're going to direct more attention at a future date on SIP program.
Okay. Right. I'm just going to explain how this.
Mr. Strom, we're going to have to get this going, then we'll have Mr. Rolfe up, and then members will probably have to have another day to finish up the rest of the testifiers and talk about the concerns of RES and SIP. So I apologize to those that have come, but we definitely wanted to get Mr. Rolfe here because he's from.
I can finish this off in.
Thank you.
A couple minutes.
Please.
All right. So this project saves a lot of money, creates a lot of jobs. And as I mentioned, there's a map here that shows where these projects occur. They occur all over where we provide these services. And this is just a small project. You'll see that in the metro area where we do a lot of work, they're all over the place. This is just a little project. If you multiply this by 10 or 20 times, which is the size of Xcel's program, you've got these projects all over the state creating these jobs. And I mentioned earlier that the purpose of SIP is to save money. If you look at what Xcel has done since 1990, their total savings for all ratepayers, less the cost of the program, is $3.5 billion. So it's a big deal. You can save a lot and lot of money, and that money then can go and create jobs. This table is just a simple summary of a study done by American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy that compares jobs in energy efficiency, other aspects of the economy, and jobs in new power plants. And clearly, energy efficiency creates many more jobs directly, and as I mentioned, indirectly creates a lot more jobs as well. So I think what we're suggesting is that energy efficiency is a great job creation tool. You could ask your utilities to provide you more information directly about the jobs they are creating. I think the state could change the emphasis of SIP a little bit to be more reflective of creating these jobs. It could be one of the measures of the effectiveness of the SIP program. So There it is. Quick as I can
you.
Do it.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, I have a question on the savings goal. Since the ultimate objective is to have energy savings, with the 1.5% each year being divided 1% customer, 0.5% utility, in your opinion, would it make more sense not to divide that out if there are times when utilities could save more, customers save less, or do you think it's wise to divide it the way it is?
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, this is actually at the discretion of the utility. So the utility could save it all through the customer if that worked, but we're trying to give the utility the flexibility to save this energy at the lowest cost. So if you can, through a utility program, encourage customers to save 1.5% every year, that's great. We'd indicated from utilities that they think there are other opportunities that may be more cost effective. So this just provides more flexibility. It doesn't say you have to do it this way.
Okay.
Senator Howe?
No.
Nope. Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Mr. Rolfe, please. Welcome to the Energy Committee, and please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Rolfe. I'm an engineer over at Medtronic, and my role is the corporate energy manager. I deal with all things energy. So it's supply side, gas contracts, electric contracts, do all the data management, pay all the bills, and then I do all the efficiency. I've been doing energy for about probably 20 years now. Medtronic's doing a lot of things in the efficiency side. We're doing a 300 kW solar project in California. We're looking at a megawatt down in Puerto Rico. We're doing lots of very interesting things on the efficiency and the whole demand side. Before that, I was 20 years at Ford Motor Company. I've been doing energy there for 15 years. Down at the St. Paul Ford plant, I worked there for 10 years with my colleague here, Lynn. We worked on the hydroelectric plant, got that thing up and running better than it used to. We did a huge savings on the heating and the lighting in the plant. So I'm a huge fan of energy efficiency. I think what Sheldon does with his group is fabulous. They're certainly barking up the right tree, hitting the efficiency side first, because that is the cheapest, cleanest, most affordable energy you can get, is the stuff you don't use. I've done landfill gas. I was with Ford on the Chicago Climate Exchange back in 2000 when it started. So I've been doing this for a while. I kind of know, 80% of everything, but not an expert in any one thing.
You're dangerous.
My goal here is to kind of, I don't really have a pro or a con against any of the programs or policies. I am actually a real middle of the roader. And what I'd like to do is just kind of present the impact of the policies to business, just so you kind of get your arms around, how these, because they all sound great independently, but it kind of ends up as a death of a thousand cuts to people like me. So I'll start, the first one, the SIP program. I think it's wonderful. Things can always be managed better, yes. Nothing's perfect. However, it's not the utility's money. It's my money. I'm the ratepayer. They take it out of my pocket, and then it gets redistributed to other people to help them save on their efficiency. Now, if you've ever seen jaywalking, there's a lot of people out there that need a lot of help because they don't know what they're doing. And, so I'm all for helping educate people and kind of guiding them down the path. The one-stop lighting program, I think, is great. Small business doesn't have time to do that kind of stuff. However, to Medtronic, I kick in a couple $100,000 a year into the SIP program. I don't get anywhere near that back because I don't have that much money to invest to get that much rebate money back. So, it's a cash loser for me, yet I still support it. So that's how strong I feel on the efficiency, because if it didn't happen, now we're building more power plants and my rates will go up. So I understand the kind of the big picture here. Medtronic, just to put it in perspective, since I got there 4 years ago, in the Twin Cities, where the only place I have any clout, we've reduced our electricity and gas consumption by 24% on a per square foot basis. So when people talk about trying to get 0.8, that's like falling off a log to me. because we're out there, we're driving it with cost. And we just really drive it. We make people held accountable. And you can get results. I mean, 24% is phenomenal in my book. So anyway, the budget impact is about 2% to my annual utility budget. The other standard, the RES, I'm a little confused because I'm not sure anybody knows how much it's cost us so far, and that, let alone what it's going to cost us. I haven't seen any numbers on what the real cost is, including the transmission lines, including the backup gas peakers when the wind isn't blowing. All that has got to be in there, and I don't know what it is. Nobody knows what it is. I'm not against the RES, but I'd like to see what the numbers are because it costs me, I'm guessing, 10% of my budget to help pay for 25% of the power that's, you could argue, costs more than base power. But I don't know. I haven't seen the numbers. So 2% on there, another 10% on RES, I think. I don't know. Smart grid. Great idea. We have to do it. We're way overdue, but that's another 2% to my budget. But it is a necessity, but we have to do it smart, right? That's the whole key there. My poster child, we don't need to give my grandma a $3,000 meter at her house so she can save $15 a month. That just doesn't make any economic sense anywhere. So, you know, when we implement it, it's not about the toys. It's about where do you put the money to make the most impact. So that's my feeling on the smart grid. Lynn referred to Dr. Amin across the street at the U. He's a national expert in this stuff. Let's take advantage. It's a homegrown thing. We could create jobs here on the whole grid management system. So that was 2%. Oh, and then by the way, we have normal existing rate cases that come by every year or two or three. That's it. Right now there's one in there for 8%. So far we've got 2, 10, 2, and 8. So now I've got a 22% cost impact to my utility budget. Well, I just worked my butt off for 4 years trying to get 24% of it out. Mm-hmm. And now it all just went right back in again. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the big elephant in the room called cap and trade. Nobody knows what that's going to cost. Certainly it's not going to be absorbed. It gets handed down to the ratepayers. Whether I'm large enough to report or not, it gets handed down to me. And if that's another probably 10%, that's another $1 million to Medtronic just in the Twin Cities. And we're not even a large user. You know, by aggregate, we're medium road, but, you know, there's some big users in town that might not be here. If this, now you add it up, that's a 30% cost increase. So that's the death of 1,000 cuts by all these little different policies. Not that I'm pro or against any of them. They're all a good idea, but you got to manage them correctly, and you got to kind of, you're in the middle of the road, you have a tough job, you have to put the pressure but still support other things, and I don't envy you on that. The future. I'm also in a unique position. 20 years in the auto industry, I can't wait for the electric transportation system to get here. I think it's going to be a real game changer. I love the concept of a plug-in hybrid. I'm not pure electric, I'm not a big fan of. And I really don't want to see any meters in the middle of the day. It should be illegal to charge your car between 9 and 6 p.m. because that's when the grid does not want 8,000 commuters plugging their car in. Okay, the grid can't take that. We want to do it at night, right, when it's cheap. And like we've said before, there's negative cost at night. That's when you plug in your cars and charge them, not during the day. It's got to be dependable 24/7 power coming. If we all start converting in this 5-10-year plan, where's this power coming from? It can't be intermittent supply. It's got to be a base load, dispatchable 24/7 available power if you got to support the grid. You don't want constituents calling you up saying, well, MISO couldn't charge my car last night because it wasn't windy and I didn't get to work. That is not going to go over very well. So it's got to be good 24/7 power. Data center, we have a huge opportunity up here because of our wonderful cold weather and our technical workforce on data centers. People are looking all over the country to move them up here. They need reliable 24/7 power, and that's a big business opportunity there, and it's got to be affordable. So we don't want to pass that up either. So that's the end of my comments, my perspective, if you have any questions.
We just have a whole day of Mr. Rolfe, yeah. Whole day of testimony, because you put a lot out there that we could just discuss back and forth, and fascinating. Senator Metzen?
I just wanted to ask a personal question, if you'll answer. You listed all these jobs you had. It looks like you're about 90 years old. Yeah. You had 20 at Ford and 20 somewhere else. And
well, 20 in the energy business.
Oh, I don't, okay. Then you kind of, Madam Chair, you kind of duplicated 20 and 20 and 20. Then, I had you down for 86
overlap.
Years old, and you don't look that old.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I was just interested to get your thoughts on Energy Star rebates, where energy utility companies offer rebates to for Energy Star appliances. What's your thoughts on
I think it's
that?
A good
Mr.
idea, Madam Chair. I think it's a good idea because, sad to say, but you know, most Americans need a lot of help when it comes to that kind of decision-making and whether to buy energy efficiency or not. You know, they all know who Snooki is, but they don't know how to buy a dishwasher. It's kind of embarrassing, but it's kind of the truth. So to give them very easy, readable things and incentives out front is, yeah, that you have to drive it through that. So I agree.
No, I'm done.
That was Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't want to get in a long debate. You make a lot of really good points. I guess I would just be a little cautious in throwing numbers around if we don't know what the real numbers are, like for the renewable energy standard. I think, you know, obviously SIP is it's a given known quantity, how much you pay out of
your... Well, it's not in my bill, so I don't know what I pay.
Well, but you know how much, what percent of the bill is. Madam Chair, sorry. Madam Chair, hey, been there. I know that's the feeling, yeah. Sorry. But the whole renewable energy standard, I mean, I know we've had testimony from Xcel in previous years that it's actually saved ratepayers money to incorporate that wind into the grid, into their system. And so, you know, I hope we can have some more testimony on that, you know, because people make assumptions it's more expensive, but there's a lot of factors involved, so.
Mr. Rolfe.
Madam Chair, I agree. What I'm asking for is show me the numbers, because nobody really has the total all-in basket of cost.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rolfe, and you mentioned your SIP program is $200,000 to $300,000 a year. When does that, is there a ceiling on that where Medtronic will say, we're not going to expand here, or we have to do something different?
I mean, in reality, because of the nature of our business, we're not a high intent, energy is not a big part of our cost of doing business. But what it does mean is, if I wasn't doing the SIP money, would I be able to spend the money on some engineers or technicians to help me reduce energy some more, maybe? Mm-hmm. Or would we put it into R&D? I'm not sure. You know, budgets will always be met. If prices go up here, something goes down over there. We have to do that.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, but obviously you are a very big fan of energy efficiency, and that's greatly appreciated too.
Absolutely.
So,
yes.
But if there's something we can do to fix what's not working for our Minnesota State businesses, then we need to do that too.
Yeah. Well, I think there could be some tweaks. I mean, I like the concept, but it's the devil's in the details. Maybe there could be caps that say certain companies will contribute to it up to a certain point, and then there's a cap so they don't have to keep mm-hmm. going. There is an off-ramp for some large industrials.
Right.
If I think it was 20 megawatts or more, you can get out. That's a pretty high number. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see it a little bit lower.
Mr. Ruff, we'll have to talk. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it was interesting. It would be interesting to me if the 24% savings or reduction in energy costs that you were able to achieve, if you could lay that out, you know, like lighting, heating, how you might have done that. Quite an achievement. I think all of us, we've put in the fluorescent light bulbs, turned down the heat. That's about all we've been able to do, and insulation and things like that. But
Mr. Ralph.
Madam Chair, it's a combination of lots of little things, but the biggest, the biggest hitters, I would say, is we built a new campus up in Moundsview, 1 million square feet, 4,000 some people. And we actually used the SIP program or the upfront engineering analysis where you would model buildings. We make decisions on the heating and air conditioning, how to do it. It's all glass building, and it's electric heat. People, you know, what? In Minnesota, are you crazy? Well, the HVAC was designed completely different than most buildings, and so the bigwigs don't have their offices on the outer glass. They're on the inside. So we use the floors are just one big floor, and between the people, the computers, and the lights and everything else, they heat the building, and we just trim it with electricity a little bit. So it's a completely different approach on how buildings are normally done. We do scheduling. I'm a huge fan of scheduling. You have the right energy at the right time. You know, lights go off at 6 o'clock. And if the VP's kind of mad, well, he's got to walk up and turn the switch back on. You know, too bad. That's how we do it. And if you get in early, lights don't go on till 7. That's just the way it is. You know, weekends, I call them cold and dark. So if you're going to come in and do your taxes on Saturday on the PC or something, it's going to be cold and dark. You don't, you know. So those are the kind, it's almost child psychology to a certain extent about having to deal with people and those sorts of things. Equipment, remodeling, you always jump in on a remodel or a new construction up front. That's the cheapest way to do efficiency. To go back in and retrofit is always painful, and it's not real cost effective compared to new construction and remodeling. So we switch old controls from the old pneumatics. You ever change a thermostat and you hear it hiss? Those are old, bad ones. You get all the new fancy electronic stuff. So when we gut a building, you know, I have to campaign internally, and I actually go to the finance people. I don't tell them what it is. I say, I have a business proposition. It's an IRR of 26%. You give me $600,000, I'll give you this much a year in profit. Yeah, what is it? I need a new air compressor. Oh, that's maintenance. No. You just told me it was a good business decision. So there's a lot of that has to get done to get that achieved.
Great. All right. Wrap this up, Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. More comment for you again. I think it would be, I mean, you know, show me the numbers is a very fair request. And in fact, if we're engaging in SIP activities that aren't cost effective, then we're outside the requirements of the statute. And so maybe this is a request of Center for Energy and Environment or Excel. You know, we saw the chart of overall savings to the state. Since we started SIP activities back in the 80s and 90s, it would be interesting to have maybe a thought exercise. What if none of that was happening? Then, you know, what would those rate cases over time look like, and what would the effect be on our bills, you know, to finance that additional baseload that we would have had to have brought online? I think that's a fair question and excellent examination for this committee, because I hear a lot about how much money we're spending on SIP and, oh my God, it's so much money, but it has to be cost effective. It has to be a direct benefit to the overall system as well as to individual payers of bills.
Right. Well, we're definitely going to revisit SIP, and as I've mentioned to all of you, that we will have a day on SIP, and I think it's something that we need to get in farther. My apologies to Mr. Moratzka and to Mr. Pagel and, of course, to Ms. Seifert. And we are going to have another day to finish up the testimony. I think this is a great discussion we've had. It will not be next week, because next week we're doing the nuclear moratorium. So we will have debate and testimony on Tuesday. And Senator Jungbauer will be the chair. I will be at the State of the Union address with Congressman Waltz. And then Friday we will have amendments and votes on the nuclear bill. Thursday. And then I'm hoping that if everybody can come back on the following Tuesday, we'll finish this discussion. Mr. Rolfe, you were great. Thank you so much for stepping up to the committee and giving us your opinions. I believe we could all say you did a great job, and you had some very interesting, great information there. And thank you for being an energy advocate. But we might want to pick your brain a little more, if that's possible.
Absolutely.
Okay, wonderful. With that, the committee is adjourned.
Say, Madam.